Lily came down to find Mercedes peeling onions at the kitchen table.
"What are you cooking, Mercedes?"
"Nothing, Lily. Go back to bed."
"It's morning. Is Francis home yet?"
Mercedes wiped her eyes with her onion hand by mistake and found herself unable to do anything but gulp.
"Mercedes,
I'm just slicing onions, Lily. Don't be foolish."
"Don't worry about Francis, Mercedes. I asked Ambrose to look after her."
Mercedes seized Lily and hugged her. Lily felt something hard pressing across her spine. Mercedes had forgotten to put down the paring knife, but Lily was too polite to say anything. James came into the kitchen rubbing his hands together, refreshed despite a night in the chair and his clothes.
"Who feels like bacon and eggs? I'll cook."
"Oh, Daddy," said Mercedes. "Don't worry about Frances. She's sure to turn up."
And she did, that afternoon, with a tiny carved ballerina for Lily. Now Mercedes has ceased to worry when Frances disappears like a cat for days, confident that she is being watched over through the special intercessions of Lily. Mercedes puts it down as another sign, and adds it to the lengthening report she will one day soon make to the bishop. Mahmoud never misses the braid because he has no idea it survived the materia purge. Francis found it under the red velvet lining at the bottom of Giselle's jewelry box. It was a close call. Mahmoud was in bed and out like a light at the other end of the room. Frances stood at her late grandmother's vanity and surveyed the loot laid out before her. Silver brushes, combs, and hand mirrors. A rosewood jewelry box. She lifted the lid and up struck a hurdy-gurdy orchestra along with a pink ballerina. Frances shut the box instantly and turned back toward Mahmoud, who groaned, rolled over, and looked straight at her. They just stayed like that, staring at each other, until she realized he was still asleep. She waved at him. She gave him the finger. She returned to the jewelry box and opened it a hair breadth. Yes, now she could see the little dancer lying flat on its face. Francis slipped a finger through the crack and pinned the thing in a dead swan position while she opened and plundered the box. She checked for a false bottom in case of cash, lifting the red velvet lining, and that was how she stumbled upon the black braid lying coiled in its jeweled nest. It must have been Mama's, because why else would it be hidden? Artifacts of lost girls are always forbidden. Frances stuffed the braid and the jewels into her guide pouch, leaving only a strand of genuine pearls. She extracted the ballerina by its roots, little red bits of velvet trailing from its pointed feet. She considered laying it on Mahmoud's pillow like an eldritch gift from the tooth fairy, but decided Lily might like to have it. Finally, she picked up the strand of pearls and carefully severed its string with her teeth. She removed one pearl, then coiled the rest back into the otherwise empty rosewood box and tiptoed from the room with her booty. What Frances really wishes she could steal or be stolen by, however, is Teresa, who still works for Mahmoud. Teresa of the black and white candy. Queen Teresa, disguised as a maid. Frances is not fooled by her big purse and simple dress. It almost seems vain for someone with a face like Teresa's to dress in clothes so humble that they serve only to highlight the beauty of the wearer. When Frances first spied Teresa letting herself in through the kitchen door with her own key, she had the wild certainty that Teresa was now Mrs. Mahmoud, my step-grandmother. But Teresa left at 6 that evening, having set out Mahmoud's supper, and Frances realized she had her own home to go to. with lucky children in it, no doubt. There is a kitchen door to the cellar, and Frances loves to sit behind its splinter of light and watch Teresa work. She does this for hours, until she turns into the dough that Teresa is kneading, or the glass that Teresa pours milk into, or the apron that she wipes her hands on. It's so peaceful that one time Frances fell asleep and tumbled all the way down the cellar steps. She hid when Teresa came down to see what the commotion was, and even though Frances was longing to say, "It's me, I hurt myself," all she said was, "Meow." One day, a man comes and eats lunch at the kitchen table while Teresa works. His name is Ginger. "Come on in, Ginger, darling." He is her darling, but not her husband. Teresa calls to Mahmood in the living room. "My brother's here, sir." Ginger wears overalls, but he's not a miner. He's too healthy looking. Frances recognizes him right away. He is the one who used to drive Kathleen back and forth to school in a black Model T Ford. He dropped off Kathleen the day Teresa gave Frances the black and white striped candy. He called to Teresa, and they drove away together, and Kathleen took Frances's candy and threw it into the creek. Frances even remembers what they had for supper that night. Steak and kidney pie. Frances wonders why stupid details like supper stick in her mind, when there are other things that she'd give anything to remember. Like the last time she felt her mother's touch. Mr. Mahmood comes in while Ginger is there and says, "Hello, Leo." And Frances nearly loses her balance on the steps again, jolted by the collision of two men in her mind. Frances sees the name stenciled on the back of the booze truck parked out front of James's still. Then the truck dissolves into the Model T Ford, but the stenciled name remains. Leo Taylor Transport. He says, "Hello, Mr. Mahmood." Mahmood asks in his dusky accent, "Have you got my special order?"
"I do, sir, Mr. Mahmood. And strong like you like it."
The surprise of recognizing Leo Taylor outweighs the surprise of seeing her grandfather guzzle a brown bottle of special order. Frances would never have pegged him for a drinker. He isn't, of course. It's only ginger beer. And when Teresa pours out glasses for herself and her brother, Frances realizes that, along with the fact that she, too, is thirsty. When she watches the fizzy gold slide past Teresa's lips and ripple down her throat, Frances feels a craving. Leo Taylor sips his slowly. Frances watches and remembers when she told Lily that her real daddy was a black man from the coke ovens. It was Leo Taylor she was thinking of, having seen him at James's still. She told Lily this story in order to find out if it was true. Like the old orange cat story. How it smothered Ambrose, and Daddy buried it in the garden. Like the story of how Mama drowned Ambrose in the creek. And the one about the old French mine. Frances needs to say a story out loud to divine how much truth runs beneath its surface. On her narrow journeys up the attic stairs by night, Frances has seen a picture she did not know she owned. Kathleen with a black-red stomach, sweaty hair, two tiny babies alive between her knees. There is no one else in the picture except the person who is looking at it. "That must be me." There is a voice way at the back of Frances's mind, hollering into a wind. She can't make it out yet. It's just a sighing sound. It's sighing a question. The question is, how did the babies get in the creek, Frances? The voice is getting closer. It's on the first step. Partly to drown the voice, and partly to enlist help in traveling to meet it, Frances tells herself another story. There at the top of her grandfather's cellar steps, behind the crack of the door, watching Teresa and her brother drink ginger beer, Frances murmurs aloud, quickly and under her breath like Mercedes saying the rosary. Kathleen is Lily's mother. Ambrose drowned because we don't know why. Kathleen was not married. She had a tumor in her belly, but she didn't, really. There was a secret father. It was Ginger. He drove her, and they fell in love on the way to school. That's why Daddy says don't play that colored music from the Hope Chest. He sent Kathleen to New Yorktown, but Ginger followed in his truck. Daddy took her home again, but it was too late. She died of twins. Do you know the ginger man, the ginger man, the ginger man? Do you know the ginger man? He lives in Ginger Lane. Amen, Lily and Ambrose.
Goodbye, Ginger, honey, says Teresa at the kitchen door. Drive safe.
Teresa washes the glasses, and Frances pads away down the cellar steps. Part of her story is true, and part of it is true enough. Frances will find out where he lives and buy herself a case of ginger beer. She shimmies up the coal chute and out into a stab of sunlight. Ginger has seen a little girl on the shore road between New Waterford and Sydney. She strays along the edge of the ditch, looking every place but where she's going. Why is she allowed to wander the highway alone like that? And why is she not in school? Who's her father? Where's her mother? She always wears a girl guide uniform, which is strange because she doesn't look old enough to be a girl guide, more like a brownie. The third time Ginger passes, they're both traveling in the same direction, and he slows down a little, thinking maybe to offer her a ride. But he decides against it, not wanting to frighten her. She looks up, though, at the slowing truck ahead, and he sees her face in the side mirror. It hurts him. Who would let their little girl walk the shore road alone day after day? He never would. He has three daughters, two brownies and one guide. He shivers and drives on. He glances at the St. Christopher medal hanging from his rearview mirror. Ginger has never had an accident. He is a good driver. But lately he has felt funny about the road. He used to see it all at once and drive as naturally as blinking and breathing. But now it's as though he sees each piece of road individually the moment his wheels roll over it. To either side, each stone and tree stands separately, and he has lost the knack of expecting the road to unfurl around the bend. Driving is his living. He can't afford to be spooked. Ever since his last trip to New York, Ginger hasn't felt right. Never quite rested or quite awake. It's as though a window has been left open inside his head, admitting a draft. He can't get to it to close it. But he can look out it, even though all he sees is fog. It rolls into his mind, obscuring his ease, setting him to shiver. Still, he looks and looks, because out there in the fog he can feel something looking back at him. His wife, Adelaide, knows there is something not right, but how can Ginger explain to her what he cannot explain to himself? He heard some music in New York. That sounds crazy. He knows it. So the least he can do is keep it to himself. Can music cast a spell? Yes. Everyone knows that. And everyone would laugh at him if he said it out loud. It was in a club up in Harlem. Ginger had time on his hands waiting for a shipment of dresses to haul back to Mahmoud's department store on Pitt Street. Whenever Ginger is in a place that's filled with other black people, it's as though he is relieved of a weight that he was unaware of until it came off him. He walked up Lenox Avenue feeling light. In Harlem, Ginger felt happy but lonely, too. Home and not home. He entered a small club on 135th Street that welcomed Negroes in the audience, not just on stage. A trio was playing quiet music for a quiet crowd. The whole scene was highly unusual. No floor show, no horns or hidey-ho. Piano, bass, and flute. Ginger stood and listened. The piano player was at the core of the trio. A slim man with long, fine fingers, hand-tooled wrists. So good that he had come to prefer playing between the music. This was not for everyone, and the pianist hadn't had a new suit in a very long time. Threadbare trousers, white shirt open at the long, handsome throat, a charcoal fedora angled low, and around its base, a shimmering green silk band. 3 minutes or 3 hours later, Ginger recognized the number as Honeysuckle Rose. But this did not prevent him from confusing his left arm with his right when he went to lift his glass of beer. The odd thing was, Ginger had homey taste in music. If it could be sung by the whole family, it was great by him. He certainly didn't claim to be any kind of connoisseur. And yet, when the pianist allowed his fingers to settle like mist onto the keys for the next interstellar tune, Ginger had to stay and listen. It was on the night drive back up to Cape Breton that he became aware of the fault line opening inside his head. And twice he had to remind himself to stop when the land ended. Once because it was time to coast onto the ferry, and once again because he was home. He hugged Adelaide as though she were the first solid food he'd had in weeks. Still, he hasn't been able to shake the unease, and sights like the lost little girl guide are bothering him perhaps even more than they normally would. The third time he sees her, Ginger means to tell Adelaide, but it slips his mind, only to return that night in a dream. He sees the thin white face in the side mirror up close, the serious brown-green eyes, one freckle on the nose. It still looks like a child, but an unspeakably old one. It is the saddest face he has ever seen. Ginger wakes up even though it's not a nightmare. For the first time it occurs to him that the little girl guide may be a ghost. What is she saying to him with her eyes? Here is how I died. Pray for me. Ginger wipes his face. It's wet, but none of the rest of him is, so it couldn't have been a night sweat. How strange. He goes and checks on all his children and their beds. When he returns, he looks down at his rusty-haired wife, who appears ready for a fight even in her sleep. Thank God for Adelaide. Ginger means to tell his sister Teresa about the little girl guide and about his dream the next day at lunch when he brings Mr. Mahmood his ginger bear treat. But again, it slips his mind. Jamil squints down at Francis. What for?
Just tell me.
Francis has awakened him in the middle of the day. He's jaundiced as the sun. Why?
Because I'll burn your fucking house down if you don't.
Jamil horks out last night's nicotine.
You just watch yourself, that's all I'm saying. Leo Taylor's got a mean wife.
It's not his wife I'm interested in.
He lives in the purple house on Tupper Street.
Francis turns to leave. Jamil shakes his head and warns,
"Just don't come crying to me."
But she ignores him. Ginger Taylor gets a jolt when he looks up from the shell in his youngest child's hand to see the little girl guide standing in his backyard staring at him.
She is a ghost. What does she want?
May I have some of your ginger beer?
Adelaide comes to the back door.
What do you want?
Frances looks up at her. The woman's reddish hair indicates to Frances the ability to see through people. Best not to answer. Adelaide doesn't take her eyes off Frances.
Who is she, Ginger?
I don't know, honey. Then he turns back to Frances.
What's your name, little girl?
Frances walks away. The child moves to follow her, but Ginger picks him up. Adelaide and Ginger watch Frances trail off down the alley. Then Adelaide says,
That's not a little girl,
and walks back into the house.
Salt. The first thing Mahmood notices is that one of the sterling combs is missing. That leads him to the rosewood jewelry box. He opens it. An empty metal post pops up and rotates to the strains of the anniversary waltz. The box is bare but for the pearls. Shaking with disbelief, he snatches them up. They slide down their severed string and spray across the floor.
Teresa! He roars.
She's up in an instant, wiping her hands, white grains of burgle clinging to them. She's making kibbeh. And the next instant, she's lucky he hasn't called the police.
Get your things and go.
Mahmood contacts his youngest daughter, and she organizes a bucket brigade of female relatives. The family is hugely attentive anyway, but full-time housekeeping for an old man is another matter. They'll have to find a paid replacement, because Mahmood's family is so successful that there are no spare females lying around. A line of Irish girls and colored girls and country girls is paraded before him, but Mahmood can't seem to decide on a new Teresa. So it falls to Camille to take up most of the slack. She is the closest thing to a widow there is. What enrages Mahmood is that he let himself be lulled into trusting Teresa, into thinking she was different. That's when the viper strikes. He should never have forgotten her color. They can be the nicest people in the world, but like children, they mustn't be overburdened with responsibility. They're like the worser sort of woman in that way, even the men. Which reminds me, I wonder if the brother was in cahoots. It's enormously aggravating at Mahmood's age to have to explain every little thing to each of the female relatives looking after him. They all do their best, but the evil truth is, none of them knows him like Teresa did. And, this is the most evil truth, none of them makes Lebanese food as beautifully as she did. Better than his own wife. God rest her soul and God forgive me. Teresa seemed to read his mind. She made everything so easy. And Mahmood knew that when the time came, he could have accepted her most intimate ministrations without yielding a particle of his dignity. Now that is a good woman. And what is her price? Above rubies, damn it. What were a few trinkets in exchange for that? He'd have willingly given her the whole kit and caboodle, every bauble and... What am I thinking? I am a foolish old man, and what is my price? An ass, if I'm not careful. I need my daughters at a time like this, my own flesh and blood. This just goes to show it. It wounds Mahmood to observe that the thefts do not end with the departure of Teresa. They resume under the increasingly continuous care of his daughter, Camille. Mahmood blames himself. In the old country, he never would have given a daughter to Jamil, because there the crucial distinction between their two families would have been clear. The Jamils are Arabs. We Mahmouds are more Mediterranean. Closer to being European, really. Such distinctions are apt to get blurred in the new country, where you open wide your arms to a brother from home who speaks the same beautiful language as you. the same shapely, humorous language with earth and water in it. What a relief it is to sit down to a meal or a game of cards with someone, a Jamil, for example, who shares this language. What a relief from the chill of English, which is exactly like immersing your tongue in ice water. And after all, to the Anglais, you are all black Syrians. Mahmoud didn't recognize until too late that his old country standards had eroded to the point where he had given his most beautiful daughter to a dirty, half-civilized Arab. Poor Camille. A good girl who has borne sons only, and 5 of them. What a waste. And he's lost Teresa to boot. Tears are shed by Mahmoud, sitting next to his bed. He has come up here to get away from a bungling granddaughter. He sits in the skirted chair that matches the bedclothes. Giselle's taste. French provincial, God rest her soul. And his eyes fall upon the carved mahogany reproduction of Durer's praying hands hanging on the wall. My wife bought that. A distant tremor for Giselle gives way to hot tears, because they are Teresa's hands. Go ahead, cry it out and be done with it. Then get down on your knees and thank God that your daughter Camille has been polluted by her no-good Arab husband into a petty thief, and that you fired Teresa for Camille's crime. Thank God, because you know that otherwise, and not too long from now, you would have asked Teresa to marry you. Mahmoud slides from the chair and clunks to the floor on his knees. It must have been God who intervened when the pearls went flying, because if Mahmoud had been thinking for himself, he never would have believed the thief could be a woman to whom he had entrusted the housekeeping money every week for the past 15 years. It was God speaking straight out of his mouth. Thank you. Infinite wisdom, infinite mercy. I am not worthy. Mahmoud kneels and weeps into his own praying hands. Beneath the bed, Francis listens, fascinated. Teresa is crying too, but with anger. She sits on the love seat in her home under the hand-tinted photograph of Bridgetown and wonders what she's going to do now. Worse than the loss of her job is the loss of her reputation. And what is its price? To have been unjustly accused. And of something so far beneath her and everything she comes from. How dare he! Hateful old man! Like all the rest, only worse. Nasty, low-down, filthy Syrian. Oh, sweet Lord! I am trying, but you make it hard. How is it possible to forgive and to live at the same time? It always ends this way. Not colored people can't stand it when a colored person gets too good at something. Teresa blames herself for believing that she was indispensable to Mahmoud. Pride goeth before a fall. She did everything for him. She remembered all the names and all the birthdays of all his grandchildren, and shopped for the endless stream of presents that bore his name. She remembered which son liked what dish, and cooked accordingly when they came for supper. She knew when to mend a sock and when to throw it out, where he had left his diamond tie pin and his reading glasses. She banked his money, paid his bills, and soothed his corns. If she hadn't done her job so well, Mahmoud would not have resented her and fired her on a vicious lie. Yes, he would. He'd have fired her for being lazy, like the rest of your people. It ends the same way no matter what, leaving you to suck salt and pray Jesus to take away the hate. Hector reaches over and brushes away a tear, which causes her to weep afresh. They have been married 13 years. All day long, Hector sits faithfully under his blanket, waiting for her to come home. Thank the Lord for Ginger, Adelaide, and their kids. Thank God for good neighbors. Otherwise, Hector would have died of loneliness by now. Hector wasn't fired. He was never unjustly accused of anything, and unlike dear Ginger, he never resorted to making a living through illegal means. Hector had a good job at the steel plant. He and Teresa were married 14 months when a half-cooked beam fell and caught him on the side of the head. Now he can go for little walks if you hold his hand, but mostly he gets pushed along in his wheelchair. Hector and Teresa had put off having children because he was going to be a minister, and they were going to move to New York City and have American children and a better life. Teresa pats Hector's hand, then goes to fetch a fresh diaper for him from the linen closet. She long ago gave up imagining what their children would have looked like. Jamil barges into Boutros's bedroom on the second floor and says, "Tell Leo Taylor to come here tonight and bring a case of ginger beer." Boutros turns from his open window and says, "I'll pick it up myself, Pa. Shut up and do what I say." "How come?" Jamil reaches up and clips Boutros a sharp one on the back of the head. "That's how come."
"Ow."
Jamil laughs and explains,
"Your cousin wants him by."
Boutros doesn't say anything. Jamil shakes his head.
"Jesus, I have to spell everything out for this kid. Takes after his mother. Queen of Sheba, friggin' Francis. By. She's after his black arse."
Boutros is trembling. With someone as big as Boutros, it's hard to tell. He is 19. Soon, he won't be able to stop himself from belting his father. Jamil laughs at Boutros, grabs his big face in both hands, squashes the cheeks together, and slaps him affectionately.
"Do what I say. Go on."
Jamil leaves, and Boutros goes back to his open window. He picks up a battered oil can from the ledge and finishes watering his marigolds and petunias. The name Boutros means Peter, and Peter means rock. And upon this rock, Jamil has built his booze can. It is Boutros's curse to be the eldest. He has 4 younger brothers. Most of them are just like Jamil and therefore well-suited to being the eldest, except for the middle brother, who is obviously headed for the priesthood. Boutros dreams of saving enough money to buy a farm, of marrying his cousin Francis and taking her and his mother Camille away to the country, where they would all be happy. They'd have a lot of children, and he would love them all, but especially he would love his wife and make his mother's last years the happiest of her life. Francis is a painted drunken whore on the outside, but Boutros sees through that because he loves her, and one day soon intends to save her.
"Pa wants you to come tonight and bring a case of ginger beer."
Ginger looks up at Boutros filling the doorway. Adelaide calls from the kitchen,
"Take it yourself, buddy."
"Papa says for mister to come."
"It's okay, Addie. I won't be long."
Ginger goes for his jacket.
"Not now," says Boutros. "Tonight after midnight."
"What for?"
Adelaide wants to know.
"I don't know, Mrs. Taylor. Pa says."
"It'll cost him,"
says Adelaide, pouring some hot into Teresa's cup. Adelaide's been making mincemeat pies and offering to beat the can off old Mahmood. Ginger says to Boutros,
"Tell him I'll be there."
But Boutros doesn't leave right away. He remains for a moment, looking down at Ginger. Finally, he turns and goes without a word.
"Did you see that?"
Ginger asks the women, returning to the kitchen table.
"Gawking at me like I was a ghost."
"That whole family's right nuts,"
says Adelaide, thinking not only of the old vulture who fired Teresa, but of mean Camille. 20 years in the coke ovens, and she's never said hello to a soul. Then there's the new Waterford branch. Too bad Ginger has to be mixed up with any of them.
"Lord have mercy on them," says Teresa, folding her hands around her cup.
"Mercy my foot," says Adelaide.
"Here, baby."
Adelaide sets a plate of Nellie's muffins in front of Ginger. He gives her a kiss, sits down and hands the jammiest one to Hector, who grins with delight. Adelaide cooks all that good plain Nova Scotia stuff. She comes from a community in Halifax called Africville. She is proud of her African-Irish United Empire loyalist blood, proud to have been baptized in Bedford Basin, and never tires of telling tales of the 1917 explosion.
"I was spared for a reason. To punch you in the nose, buddy. To dance with you tonight, honey. To see my babies grow."
Later, when Teresa and Hector have gone and they've put the kids to bed, Adelaide says, not looking at him,
"Don't go to that place, Leo."
"I have to, baby."
"Then come right back. Don't linger."
"No desire to."
"Come here,"
she says, looking at him. He smiles and obeys her. Ginger carries the crate up to the front door of Jamil's speak. He hates this place. He can hear the usual party going on inside. He can smell the booze from out here, and it smells like the raw material used to make vomit. He feels sorry for Jamil's wife. On second thought, he'll go round the back. Ginger dislikes using a back door, but in this case, he'd rather enter unnoticed by the crowd that turns like one queasy beast every time someone walks in. Never mind the floozy on piano who smells like a sick baby.
"I should quit this job. See if I can get on at the steel plant."
But Ginger knows there's no work to be had there or anywhere else. Not even for white men. It's like a blow to his stomach when Ginger walks into the cold storage room and sees the girl guide uniform filthy and strewn across the empty kegs, stockings, beret, the little pouch. He looks about instinctively for the nude body. This is what happens to little girls who aren't looked after. "I should have found out who she was. I should have given her a drive." He calms down a little when he doesn't see her. But that's not to say she hasn't been dragged outside by one of Jamil's drunks and raped. Ginger is suddenly enraged. To be working for a man like Jamil. To be helping keep a place like this going in the very neighborhood where his own daughters are growing up. Ginger pounds on the door. Boutros opens it and says,
"Pause over there."
Ginger shoves his way through the crowd with his crate, past the tart on piano. "Jeepers, creepers, where'd you get those peepers?" Then finds Jamil.
"Jamil, what happened to that little girl with the guide uniform?"
"That's Mr. Jamil to you, boy."
Ginger drops the crate and grabs Jamil by the collar.
"Where is she, you devil?"
A cold pain on the back of Ginger's neck, and he's looking at Boutros's shoes. Jamil is laughing down at him.
"He wants it bad."
A cold drop splashes onto Ginger's forehead. He looks up. The prostitute in the orange wig is chug-a-lugging a bottle of ginger beer. He can see the white underside of her chin and her grime collar.
"She's right here, Leo boy,"
smirks Jamil.
"Help yourself. Cash only."
She looks down at Ginger with serious green-brown eyes. Golden froth trickles out of the corner of her smeary red mouth. He covers his eyes with his hands.
"I'm quitting. I'm not driving anymore,"
is all Adelaide can get out of him 20 minutes later. He needs a good cry, so let him.
"You've been working too hard. Let's throttle back a bit, eh, bye?"
All he can do is nod and sob against her until he falls asleep. Adelaide hugs him and counts 5 weeks since that last New York run. Something's not right. In the morning, it all seems like a bad dream. He tells Adelaide, "Jamil's got a little girl hustling there." Adelaide listens. "And it made me think of our own girls, and what would happen if..." "I know, honey." He's too sensitive. "Why don't you take it easy today?"
"I'm all right, Addie. I feel fine."
And he climbs into his truck. He drives away and realizes he forgot to tell Adelaide the whole point of the story. That the child prostitute is the little girl guide who came into their yard that day. And that he's seen her on the road and in the side mirror of his dream. But he forgot. And what was it Adelaide said about the girl guide that day? "That's not a girl guide." Well, obviously not a real one. He knows that now.
"I'll tell Adelaide tonight,"
he thinks, and turns onto the shore road. Harum Scarum. At first, Frances wondered when Teresa was going to get back from her holiday or her illness or whatever it was. But this afternoon, as she walks the shore road to New Waterford,
a horrible thought occurs to her.
What if Teresa has been fired? What if Mahmood pinned the thefts on her? He'd be crazy to. Why, just yesterday, Frances helped herself to a Royal Doulton shepherdess and a Chinese fisherman from the piano, and Teresa had been gone 3 days by then. In his truck, Ginger realizes that he's been searching the shore road for the girl guide. He wants to talk to her, that's all, but not at the speak. He wants to find out who her father is, where her people are, if she has any. And if she doesn't, maybe he and Adelaide can help. Frances doesn't look or stop walking when she hears the truck breaking on the soft shoulder behind her.
"Hey there."
She stops but does not turn.
"Excuse me, little miss."
She turns and looks up at him leaning out the window of his cab.
"I was right," thinks Ginger. 12 at the most."
She walks to the truck, steps up on the running board, and gets in beside him. She has already pegged him for a nice man. This may take some time.
"What's your name, dear? Who's your father?"
As he pulls back onto the road.
"My name is Frances Euphrasia Piper. My father is James Hiram Piper. My grandfather is Ibrahim Mahmood. I don't know his middle name."
Ginger doesn't take his eyes off the road. He is shocked, can't think what to say.
"Is that right?" he says. "I knew your sister, Kathleen."
"I know."
He glances at her. She's looking at him.
"I used to drive her, you know. I'm Leo Taylor."
"I know."
Ginger sees a tree go by on his left, then a rock, another rock. He says the normal thing and feels as if he's lying even though he isn't.
"It was a real shame her passing away like that so young. She was a really pretty gal."
"I know. I saw her."
"I guess you've seen photographs, eh?"
"I remember her perfectly well."
"But you wouldn't have even been born yet."
He chuckles, which really is a lie.
"I was going on 6, she says. "I remember everything."
Ginger breaks and pulls over, pebble by pebble.
"What's the matter?"
"I thought you were a child."
"You're Teresa's brother, eh?"
"Yeah."
He feels a bit dizzy. "It's the driving. I can't drive anymore."
"How come she's not at my grandfather's anymore?"
"She got fired. He said she stole, but she didn't."
"He'll be sorry."
He sits up. "Look, you. Does your daddy know what you're doing?
And why are you doing it anyway when you got a good home and a family?
Because I'm bad.
He looks at her.
No, you're not.
How do you know?
Ginger takes a breath. His eyes water and he says,
I can tell by looking. In your eyes. You're not bad. You're just lost.
I know exactly where I am.
That doesn't mean you're not lost.
He reaches out and cradles the side of her face in his hand. She's got wise eyes. They make him feel so deep, dry, sad that something must be done.
I want you to come home with me and talk to my wife. She's a good woman.
Do you want to be my friend?
I'd like to help you, honey.
Then take me with you, where you're driving.
I can't do that.
You did it for my sister.
I never took your sister halfway across the continent.
Where did you take her?
School and back. What do you think?
Little Ginger Man, I need someone to look after me. I'm full grown, but I'm just a little girl inside. I want you to find me, 'cause I'm lost. I'm lost in a deep, dark place. Please, please, please. Oh, you smell nice.
He takes her hand away and pushes her, not roughly, to the far end of the seat.
Where do you want me to drop you?
The Empire.
He guns into New Waterford and Frances hops down in front of the picture house. It's a talkie today, but Frances buys a ticket anyhow. She has some thinking to do. She knows now what it is she must accomplish for Lily. There remains, however, one piece of unfinished business. Camille has often imagined herself a widow. She would return home and look after Pa, and he'd realize she was the only daughter who really loved him. It has weighed on her that he has been all alone in that big house since Mama died, with only a colored woman to wait on him. Camille has cried over that.
It's the only thing she has cried over since the early days of her marriage, when she still had the energy to cry over herself.
So now that Teresa is gone, Camille is in her element. Her one regret is that she is obliged to return home nights. Camille knows that Teresa is not a thief. The jewels that went missing from Ma's rosewood box have reappeared at the speak, encrusting Frances's fingers, dangling from her ears and glittering round her scrawny neck. The silver tail of a comb pokes out her guide pouch. If Camille could incinerate Frances with her eyes, Frances would have been blown away by now. But Camille has a good reason for keeping mum about the jewels. She frisks her father's house top to bottom to find the breach where the pest has got in. Down in the cellar she glimpses the guilty crack of light framing the swing trap at the top of the coal chute. She nails a board across it for now, and goes upstairs to the front hall, where she telephones the hardware store. Frances waits patiently inside the closet until Camille gets off the phone and returns to the kitchen. Then she bounds soundlessly upstairs, two at a time, into the master bedroom, where she prepares for tonight's performance, her last on this stage. Camille has sealed up the rat hole, but she doesn't breathe a word about the rat. If Pa found out it wasn't Teresa who stole, then he would hire her back and send Camille home to her husband. Mahmoud has spent the day at his store as usual, sitting out front, carving soapstone and playing checkers with the other old fellas while his sons run things. They have expanded the business, and now they are a major maritime import-export company, with a big warehouse in Sydney and headquarters in Halifax. Shipping is next. Mahmoud never played the stock market, never bought on credit, and it has paid off. The world economy lies in ruins, but the family business is expanding. The Mahmood boys honor their father by allowing him to feel that he is still the boss. Hence,
"Sure, Pa. Whatever you say,"
before going ahead and doing what they know is best. Mahmood has passed an agreeable day growling at his grandsons and watching the street go by. Everybody knows him. Everybody respects him. He wears a plaid shirt and a dove gray jacket and tie, just as he did every day of his working life. Today is Wednesday, so on his way home he looks forward to stuffed kusa the way Teresa makes it. He's been forgetting like this lately. It's not so bad if he remembers before he opens the front door. Then he can prepare himself for her absence. But if he makes it all the way to the kitchen, and over to the stove to taste what's in the covered dish,
"Teresa,"
he calls in disbelief at how she has murdered her specialty with salt, only to turn and see Camille at the top of the cellar steps.
"What is it, Pa?"
"Nothing."
He does not blame Camille. The best cook of the family is not quite as good as Teresa, and Camille is the only bad cook. Another effect of her wrong marriage. An unhappily married woman is necessarily a bad cook, and therefore his own fault, as well he knows. Just as it's his fault she's a thief.
Well, why shouldn't she have her mother's pretty things? She has little else, not even a talent for food.
He forgives her.
"Are you starved, Pa?"
He grunts and shuffles away. He doesn't want to see her sallow smile. She makes him feel tired. He'll just have a snooze before attempting supper, which will taste, as usual, like the Dead Sea. He forgives her because he does not love her. He comforts himself with the thought of his other daughters, whom he does love.
"Please God, the one with grown children will be widowed soon and deliver me from Camille. God forgive me, I didn't mean that."
After supper, Mahmood drinks a big glass of water and falls asleep in his mauve satin chair in the front room. Nothing quenches his thirst or his fatigue these days. He thinks a lot about Giselle. Not in the ordinary way, as of the dear departed, but as though she had just stepped from the room. And for the first time in 32 years, he admits the memory of Materia. She appears with her black braids and mischievous smile. He is unaware of the smile on his own lips.
"Lahaun, ya helwi."
She looks like her mother, and she ran off at about the same age Giselle was when Mahmood married her, but that was different. Oh, very. That was in the old country where they had everything in common. The old country was part of Syria then, and a lot of people were emigrating to America. He and Giselle ended up in Cape Breton because of the lying mongrel of a sea captain who took their money, then dumped them on this barren rock. Days of peering at the horizon, waiting for land, and finally, land. Waiting to see the Statue of Liberty loom up, to dock at Ellis Island before ferrying to the blessed Isle of Manhattan. They dropped anchor in Sydney, and the captain turfed them out.
"What's the difference? It's an island, ain't it?"
Jamil's father was on that boat, too. Mahmood had no way of knowing that Jamil Sr. was fleeing creditors in Syria, because he said he was fleeing the Turks and the Druzes like everyone else. And when asked for his own story, Mahmood replied,
"The godforsaken Muslim devils."
In fact, he and Giselle left because her family was set to arrest him and stick her in a convent. But it was different from what happened with Materia and the Anklis bastard. For one thing, he and Giselle were both from the same race, culture, language, and faith. Although Giselle's family did not see it that way. They were doctors and lawyers, spoke more French than Arabic, considered themselves more Mediterranean,
even European. They were from Beirut. He was an Arab from the south. He had returned to Lebanon, land of his birth, having spent his boyhood picking cotton in Egypt.
"Don't tell me what it is to work."
He took Giselle to a better place across the ocean and gave her everything her own family would have and more. As soon as he could, he forbade her to work, even though, being the good woman she was, she resisted at first. He honored her, never laid a hand on her in anger, never had to. He gave her a beautiful house, servants, jewels each anniversary, a silk negligee from Beirut to make up for the fact she'd never had a wedding gown, 3 shades of Mediterranean blue and a veil with a fringe of real pearls. The veil was purely for fun, of course, a romantic joke. The sight of her in this outfit was unimaginably exciting. If only her arrogant family could have seen what Mahmoud achieved in the new world.
"Pa! Pa!"
He wakes with a half-moan to see Camille. She's got her coat on and the room is dark.
"I'm going home now, Pa."
"Where's your mother?"
He's speaking Arabic, but she replies in English to help him back to his senses.
"Wake up, Pa. Do you want something before I go? A nice cup of tea."
"Oh, what? It's time for bed. Where's to..." "Oh. No, no, no. I'm going to bed." Camille goes to help him, but he casually swats her away as he rises.
"I'll turn the light on for you, Pa."
"No, no, go home, Camille."
Oh, his life. What has become of his life? There is nothing more for Camille to do. She has laid out his pajamas. He doesn't want the light. Mahmoud reaches the foot of the stairs, and with a slight wave of his hand, he says without turning,
"Thank you, Camille."
If his other daughters could hear Pa saying thank you. "He never says thank you to me."
"Me neither, dear. He's never said anything to me except close your legs."
Mahmoud thanks Camille because he does not love her. Camille watches him slowly mount the stairs until he disappears into the darkness of the landing. Then she leaves, although she knows it's a sin to leave an old man alone in that big house all night, even if he does insist.
"Am I the only one who cares?"
she wonders. But he is not alone. There is someone else who cares enough to keep him company through the long, lonely night. Mahmoud awakens smiling a few hours later to the sound of an Arabic comedy routine. A husband and wife chiding each other about faithfulness. Then they break into a love song. He had this record and many others brought over from Beirut. He and Giselle used to sit side by side on the sofa and never tire of laughing at the same jokes. Then she would dance for him and he for her. But only when the children were out. And only sometimes. But what precious times. His smile dies upon his lips when the impossibility of what he is hearing hits him. What? Is he dead? Is there a thief in the house? Playing his scratchy old records? Why? He puts on his velvet robe, ties the cord around his waist and creeps down the stairs. He is dead. He must be. There is Giselle. Beyond the archway, the front room is aglow with candlelight and 3 shades of Mediterranean blue. Swirling and swaying and quarter-turning, hips beckoning, fingers twining in air, wrists caressing one another above her head, the pearls of her veil swinging to the rhythm of the reeds, the drums and the wailing voices of the love song.
Mahmood is filled with desire and his heart hurts, stirring again after such a long period of inactivity, never having been particularly athletic. She has seen him, and now she is luring him into the dance. Oh. He travels through the archway, he does not know how. She bends forward in her circle of firelight. The blue silk wafts open at her breasts in shadow. Come closer, the better to see me, Habibi. Her eyes are full of fun above the veil, and her fingers tickle the emptiness between her and her beloved. Closer, closer. Giselle, he whispers, reaching out to her. She giggles and he laughs too, not knowing what's funny. Giselle, he whispers, Habibti. But she slips out of the ring of light and vanishes. He calls her, but she does not answer. He picks up a candelabrum. Knowing better than to turn on electric lights when seeking a vision, and searches the ground floor, the cellar. He goes back up to the front room. He blows out the candles and turns on the electric chandelier because he can feel she is gone. The record has ended. There's just the repetitive sigh at its center. He removes the needle and returns to his bedroom. He opens his wife's oak wardrobe where all her fine clothes still hang among mothballs. There at the back is the shimmering blue with its whispering veil. He must have been dreaming. But what about the candles? The record?
Losing my mind. Or else it was an imposter. I don't care.
He reaches out to touch the silk, which is impossible to feel if there is a lifetime of work on your hands. He touches it but does not feel it, just as he saw what he could not have seen.
I don't care what you were. Come back to me. Please, please, please. Oh.
It's his last thrill and his last sting of love, as fresh and painful as youth transplanted over time and an ocean.
There is nothing left for him now except to die. But that will take a while because he is a creature of habit, and he has got into the habit of being alive.
Thief in the Night. It wouldn't matter to Frances if Ginger were a cruel man. She would do the same thing. Kindness or cruelty, it's all by chance, and what's worse anyway? It's easier to endure cruelty, so maybe kindness is worse. The only question is, how do you get a nice man to do a bad thing? She stops drinking. She wants all her wits about her for what lies ahead. Frances without liquor is a bit scary to her customers. No more cutie pie patter or kisses for gin. She takes cash up front and services them cold-bloodedly with the communion glove. Dripping with her grandmother's jewels, she no longer bothers to change out of her coal-smeared guide uniform. And at the piano she plays Chopin while speaking blues lyrics in a loud monotone despite a chorus of boos. When she strips, she doesn't sing or shimmy. She undresses like an automaton and bellows in a leaden voice, Irene, good night, Irene, good night, good night, Irene, good night, Irene, I'll ream you in my dreams. She's no fun anymore. Soon they'll look elsewhere. It's almost as though Frances despises her customers when she's sober. And what could be more insulting? Because what right has she? Frances.